This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Health and Living, and you're listening to an edited recording of the third and final panel session on healthcare financing at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality. On this panel, T. Shao-Yik spoke to Azrul Mohamed Kalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, and Marco Dell, CEO of the Life Insurance Association of Malaysia, where they discussed policy reforms and systemic changes that need to take place to ensure a sustainable and affordable healthcare system for all. This event was presented by AIA, enabling healthier, longer, better lives.
One thing we all can't run away from is that we need healthcare at some point. We will all need more healthcare because we know we're all living longer. We're all becoming more health savvy. We know what the issues are. But at the end of the day, can we all afford it, right? We want better quality as well. So in this session with my esteemed panelists, I hope we can discuss a broader look at the policies that we can improve, at how what kinds of systemic changes we can make as well. And, you know, bring it back to each of us, what each of us as individuals could potentially do to change how much comes out of that pocket at the end of the day when we need healthcare, especially when crisis time hits, right? We don't want a future where we fall sick and continue to get sicker just because we can't afford to pay. Azrul, why are healthcare costs becoming more expensive?
Thank you, Shari. There are quite a number of reasons why, and we know this very familiar trinity, basically. One is that more and more Malaysians are living with non-communicable diseases. So we have diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, this whole litany of NCDs that are chronic, they're long-term, and they're costly in terms of treatment. There is also the fact that we have more and more new technologies for healthcare that are becoming available. We have to remember, Malaysia is not a developing country. We are an upper middle income economy. We are going to be a high income economy, similar to what you see in the UK and the US and in Taiwan, South Korea, and so forth. And therefore, healthcare needs also increase accordingly. And we want to make sure that we have the best kind of healthcare possible and the kind of quality that has served us well during the recent COVID-19 pandemic. And thirdly, is the fact that when Malaysia's earning power also increases, the demand for that kind of healthcare also increases. And therefore, the combination of this results in there being a very high medical inflation, I would argue, for Malaysia, for which we are very concerned about. But also, it is one of the growing pangs, so to speak, that is inevitable as a result of the high quality universal healthcare coverage that Malaysia is able to provide to its citizens.
Medical inflation, what's that, Mark?
Maybe I just speak to the issue from the angle of medical claims inflation, right? Because when you talk about medical inflation, you look at the actual cost of services and the change year by year. But when you talk about medical claims, you also have to take consideration to behavior amongst insurers who are designing plans, behavior for policyholders who are consuming the plans, and behavior of providers, right? So individual medical insurance has only been popular in Malaysia for about 20 years, right? And since the advent in around year 2000 and on, companies have been trying to, you know, they've been fighting this sort of battle amongst themselves to keep getting better and better policies, right, to compete in the marketplace. Higher limits, covering more, doing away with internal limits. Now, today, the standard plan today covers everything, right, for inpatient, even pre- and post-hospitalization, right? That has led to some contribution to higher claims, and I'm a policyholder as well, right? So I'm paying a premium, and now I have to use it, I have to go into the hospital. The bill is going to be paid for, expected to be paid for by my insurance company, right? So two things in my mind. Number one, I'm not that concerned about the cost because it's not coming out of my pocket, right? So I'm not going to be a mindful consumer in that way, right? And secondly, you could feel like, well, I pay this premium, so I'm entitled to consume as much healthcare services as I want, as I can. Okay, and actually in the industry we call this the buffet syndrome, right? You're paying your premium, so you go in, you're entitled to claim as much as you can. So this has contributed to overconsumption, right? Now on top of that, you have issues with providers, and you should know that in the private healthcare sector, doctor's fees and other expenses associated with the doctor costs are all regulated, right? They have a schedule of benefits. But 60 to 70% of your hospital bill are hospital charges, which are not regulated. And hospitals are businesses with shareholders that expect to make a profit and expect to make more profit this year than last year, next year than this year. And since the money isn't coming for the claim, isn't coming from the patient, then there are many providers that actually look to optimize how much money or services they could deliver in order to get a higher claim from the insurance company. So these behavior issues also contribute to the many things that Osril talk about. And I'll just add one more point there, and that is our aging society. And we may not really feel it as much today as we will 10 years from now and 20 years from now. But Malaysians are getting older and living longer. And the challenge with that is the utilization of healthcare increases exponentially as you get older. You know, for the average medical insurance, about 1 in 10 policyholders will claim in a year. That's across the board, old and young. But for those, say, over 70, 75, it becomes 1 in 2. So, and when you get into that 1 in 2, you know, it becomes a very expensive proposition. I personally am very concerned about sustainable financing in the private sector for healthcare for seniors. And I think that's another issue that we have to deal with.
Yeah. Are you concerned about the low insured rate among Malaysians? So, you know, I don't know if this is the most recent statistics, but private health insurance in Takaful is only about 7% of health expenditure. There's a hefty portion where people are still paying out of pocket, I think something close to 40%. Yep. Yep. And that's, you know, all of you, you know, 40% of you could be using your life savings, you know, savings that really, you know, when in times of a medical catastrophe may not even be enough to cover. What's the disconnect there, Mark?
Well, first, I think you have to understand the statistics. So when they talk about national healthcare consumption, it includes everything. It includes what you spend at the pharmacy. It includes what you might spend on wellness. So a lot of the out-of-pocket is also a bigger basket of things, right? So am I concerned about not enough Malaysians being insured? I think certainly, right? But there are more than 9 million Malaysians that have private medical insurance, and that number is growing significantly year by year. The last number of years has been about adding about another 500,000 people a year that own private medical insurance. But I can tell you there will be greater benefits if we could turn 9 million into 18 million and 18 million into 27 million. So and maybe we'll talk about it later, the idea of a national health scheme to underpin the core financing has a lot of merit, and I really hope that the government will take this seriously this round.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get into that. But, you know, when you're talking about increasing more insured from 9 million insured to 18 million insured, are you talking about it from the industry perspective? What's the consumer's perspective? What's the benefit to them? You know, well, and I'm talking about how do I balance paying those annual premiums against, you know, I need the cash flow for a lot of other competing demands on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I think obviously the target audience for private medical insurance is the middle class and above, right? The lower income group struggles with other priorities, frankly, right? And the public healthcare sector is there. To me, health insurance is an essential because, you know, there's a chance of a catastrophic event that could actually turn your life financially and otherwise upside down, right? So when you look at the list of priorities and things you have to pay for, to me, it's a must. I must have health insurance. Now, I personally don't need to have health insurance that's going to pay for every penny of my health care. So I think there's not enough discussion and dialogue out there between advisors and customers about what amount of cost share can I afford to take on that can lower my premiums. But I think it's when you talk about life insurance and medical insurance is the closest thing that our industry has to a demand product. I mean, so it really is close to the top, I think, in a lot of people's priority list.
You're listening to an edited recording of the third panel session at this year's Health and Living Live 2022 by AIA Vitality. We'll be right back after this break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. This is an edited recording of the third and final panel session at this year's Health and Living Live 2022 by AIA Vitality on Healthcare We Can Afford. Here's the second part from that session.
Shall we? Maybe if I could share with the audience some data, some statistics concerning healthcare expenditure in Malaysia. It last year's health expenditure was estimated to be around 69 billion or 4 to 5% of the GDP. And this has increased by 20 times compared to where we were maybe 15, 20 years ago. And if you look at the public health budget for 2022, it was 32.4 billion, which is around 50% of the health expenditure, which represented only a 1.5% increase from the previous year. Now, this has been stated as being the highest amount that has been allocated for public health expenditure ever. And obviously, it increases every year in this respect. But think about it. Think about what you've read in the media, what you've heard. And you've heard that when it comes to public health care, we have underinvested, and it's a chronic situation. You've all heard it. You've heard it from the DG.
They've experienced it as well, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Going to hospitals, long waiting times. You can't get your ECGs
exactly.
And MRIs done.
Yeah. So there's been a chronic underinvestment in the people who are staffing our healthcare system, the services, the infrastructure. Some of the hospitals are more than 200 years old and look like it and are like it in some of this. And I don't fault this because we have some of the best people working in healthcare in this region, in Malaysia, and they're being underserved because we have not invested enough, which has resulted in us demanding for more investment in things like mental health, disabled facilities, for different infrastructure, for allied services, physiotherapy. But where's the money going to come from? And this is the problem right now, because we are working on a system that has not changed since the mid-80s. And last time I checked, healthcare still did not cost 1 ringgit or 5 ringgit. But in public healthcare, that's what we're charging. So if you look at how the government gets back its money, it is subsidizing 98% of all expenditure.
I wanted to point out a pretty good comment. Is our healthcare really universal, factoring in long waiting times, difficult access, you can't even get parking half the time. I'm not going to ask you to address this because it's just part of that bigger problem of underinvestment. Here's another one about Obamacare. Will Malaysia consider to mimic Obamacare? And we can continue to, you know, talk about the financing already. Here we have Perkeso. It's a type of insurance, but it's only related to work-related injuries. Can this be expanded to include healthcare?
Well, for one thing, we don't need Obamacare. Honestly, the Obamacare, the way it's fashioned over there, it's market full of insurance providers. But in reality, in Malaysia, we don't need Obamacare because we actually technically have universal health coverage. And what this means is that anybody here, including a non-Malaysian, can walk into a public healthcare facility and get treated, can get treatment, can be hospitalized, get surgery, etc. There's nothing to prevent them from being able to do that. The only issue is in terms of access and affordability. So the issue right now is how can we continue to make what we enjoy today possible for the next 50 years? How do we make it sustainable? How do we make sure that not only is it able to maintain, but also increase the kind of coverage that's available? Today, the problems of access are in rural areas, in urban areas where there is an overflow, there's too many people. There is a lack of retention of healthcare personnel, which we see amongst, I think, contract doctors recently is a big issue, and so forth. So these are issues that are all manifestations or symptoms of the fundamental question of how much money are we providing to the healthcare system? Can we do something different? Is there a better way forward to financing? And that's why, for me, Obamacare, we don't actually need that kind of system. What we need is more like what Taiwan has, for example, or the Netherlands or the UK, where there are either single or multi-payer systems where we can all pool our resources and risk to make healthcare much more affordable.
Mark, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with Osril. I don't think we need Obamacare. I'm not an expert on Obamacare, but when you look at Malaysia and you look at the two-tier system, what we really need is a greater integration and coordination between the public and private, right? So when you look at the public sector, they lack capacity, they lack funding, they lack the specialists, right? And so the private sector has more of those resources, right? And so I really think there needs to be a greater, I don't know, coordination, integration between the public and the private healthcare. And I just make a point about spending, right? So as Osril said, Malaysia spend about 5% of GDP on healthcare. When you look at developed countries like the UK, it's more like 12%, 14%. When you look at the US, it's 16% of their GDP they spend on healthcare. And so not to say that spending more is just the answer, but it just really brings to light, right, the fact of how underinvested we are in Malaysia on that topic.
And we had a question when it comes to public healthcare. Is the problem underinvestment or insufficient investment, or is it actually misdirected investment, Azrul?
I totally agree that we could do with more money, but it's also about how we spend that money as well. And there, as I mentioned just now, there are fundamental issues that we need to be able to address, things like being able to recruit the best in terms of the healthcare professionals that we have. Why are we losing so many of our best and brightest to the private sector? It's because the private sector has more ability to pay them more. Why can't we pay more to the surgeons, the professionals, the specialists, so that they stay in public sector? So we've got to think around realistic models of being able to recruit people, but also to continue to build on Malaysia's healthcare system today. You know, Shawi, if I were to say that everybody has to pay a premium based on the current budget of health today, 2022, 32.4 billion, how much would you have to pay each to be able to contribute to that? The answer would be 2,500 ringgit per working individual. That's how much. So if we're thinking about putting together a premium or a national health insurance, we have to work backwards. And it's like, this is how much you would have to pay. But how can we then make sure you co-pay? That means you pay a part of that amount in order for you to contribute towards that bigger pool so that we can talk about building better and more well-invested systems. So it's not just about how much money you put in, but also being able to put it where it's needed. And things like mental health, for example, has been a neglected area and it needs to be further invested in.
So is that the solution that you think is feasible for Malaysia? For Malaysians to pay more towards their healthcare? Because already they feel like healthcare is becoming more expensive.
Okay, Shawi, I'm probably going to get booed by saying this. But I feel that, to be honest, based on what we've been able to have today in our healthcare system, we need to relook at how we contribute and invest in our health and come to the realization that actually we need to pay more. We need to invest more in something like a national health insurance where everybody contributes, not just the middle class, but also the B40, for example. They also need to be able to contribute. But the reality is that we must all pay, we must pull our weight. We must all contribute towards this a healthcare crisis because we are in a crisis. And the reality is that we cannot there's no such thing as a free lunch. And certainly, with this 1 ringgit and 5 ringgit model that we have today needs to be reformed. It has to go. And we need to realistically look at our needs, not just for today, but for the next few decades to come.
So for the benefit of our audience, they may not be falling so much into the category of, you know, needing to access underfunded public health services. So Mark, I guess they're more your clients because they're probably buying some form of insurance and using that at private healthcare facilities. How does the idea of a national health insurance gel with that? And are we then looking at paying, co-paying to a government-managed fund as well as buying private health insurance on top of that?
Well, I think it's quite complicated, and actually the insurance industry would welcome an opportunity to get into the conversation in the formative stages with the government on whether that's...
I hope you will be.
I hope so. We keep knocking on the door, but we haven't got an answer
yet. Knock louder.
I think there's a couple things. First of all, there are segments of the population that the government has to be the primary provider or primary payer, right? And that's the lower income group and I think the seniors as well. And so if I look at Singapore as an example, and Singapore has a quote national health insurance scheme. It's an integrated plan where the government takes the first level of responsibility for everybody, okay? Everybody, no qualification, no pre-existing conditions, none of that, cover you for life. And on top of that, the private insurers will write additional cover for those who want to buy additional cover above and beyond the basic. Now, in addition to that, as you know, in Singapore, the quality of the public healthcare sector is quite good. It delivers probably about 80% of the healthcare to the Singaporeans. And on top of that, they also have... They die their best. They struggle a bit, but they have a bit of means testing with, you know, for those who can or can't afford, right? And that has some bearing on what they pay themselves to contribute to the cost of the healthcare. So it's definitely doable. I think the insurance sector would welcome meaningful discussions about how public and private can be integrated to deliver healthcare across the country.
Azrul, can you give any more elaboration? What your thoughts on what this kind of scheme would look like?
It can actually look like the way we are already contributing to EPF today through payroll. So today, a lot of people don't realize they're contributing not just income tax, but also EPF, the Employment Insurance Scheme and the EIS. And then there's something else. There's one more additional payment that's made. Oh, SOCSO.
SOCSO, yeah.
SOCSO. So you're already contributing already through the payroll mechanism, which makes it a lot easier so that your take-home pay is basically yours. So what we can do today is to make use of the mechanisms that are already in place, which we've already seen collection well to be done through the payroll approach. But the question really that will be in your minds is how much do I have to pay? And that's going to be the issue here. Because if you're coming from the middle class, you might feel it's going to be unfair that I'm going to be taking on yet another amount and I'm going to have to pay for other people who are much less able. But the reality here is that this is where we need a much more fairer model. Though we're going to use means tested, and at the end of the day, the total amount may be 2,500 ringgit a year. When you look at it in terms of how much you would need to pay, it's actually much less per month. So it's spread out across the different demographics, the different sectors, but also based on your earning capacity. And here's the thing. Today, the B40 are largely left out and it's highly subsidized. What I would argue is that they too need to contribute to this health insurance scheme as well. And how would we go about doing that? Funny enough, the insurance and the telco committee have actually shown one way we can do it, which is through the use of prepaid reload coupons, which are regularly utilized and accessed by the B40. And we can actually make sure that contributions towards the national health insurance can be actually collected through this as well. So the point here is, if we're wanting to take care of our society, our population today, but also invest in the aging population for tomorrow, we need to change the way we look at healthcare today. Because I can tell you this, the health minister's speech recently at the National University of Singapore has given a clear warning that it seems like the days of increases for the health budget is coming to an end. We need to find new sources of revenue. We need to find new funding. And most importantly, we need to increase investment in our healthcare system. We need to find where that money should come from. So we need to be honest with ourselves and take responsibility and invest in making sure that everybody is covered, not just the M40 or T20, but also the B40 that's able to be provided with the kind of services that we all need. Equity is something that needs to be emphasized and again and again when it comes to healthcare.
I'm curious, will a national scheme like this address certain pain points when it comes to private insurance now, like if you're beyond a certain age, you can't get coverage? Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, as Azra was talking, I think there are two examples that come to my mind in places that I've actually lived, right? One is Taiwan and the other is in Singapore. Taiwan has universal health insurance for everyone. It's paid for through a payroll tax. When I was there, which is now more than 10 years ago, it was about 6% of payroll tax paid by the employer, right? And it covered every man, woman, and child in the entire country. And there were modest co-payments, maybe a bit more than what we find here, but relatively modest co-payments.
Co-payments would be from the individual?
Yes, when they utilize the services, right? Not a perfect system, because there were often waits, not unreasonable waits, but and you lose some of the intimacies, you know, it's more about efficiently delivering rather than the experience, right? That's one example. The other example is in Singapore. So Singapore tried to address this problem a number of years ago by providing a very basic form of national health insurance to everyone, and it was underwritten by the government. Okay, so the government itself, who is a co-insurer with the private sector for medical insurance in Singapore, they said, here's the basic plan for all Singaporeans, no matter what age, right? Everything is covered, no pre-existing conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the basic plan. On top of that, you can buy additional coverage through any number of private players, right? And it's funded mostly through CPF contributions. I think Audrey alluded to this, right? So they have a MediSave account in Singapore. And premiums or contributions from the employer and employer go into the MediSave account. And from that MediSave account, you can either make cash withdrawals to pay out-of-pocket expenses or use the savings for your medical insurance premiums. And the government controls the design and the whole administration, right, of the medical insurance premiums. And
so it's forced medical savings, isn't it?
Yeah, it is forced medical savings, yes. But on top of that, they provide the different tiers of coverage, right, according to the individual circumstance.
I wanted to just add on to the point that today, whether you realize it or not, that the government makes decisions on things like treatment or introduction of new treatments into Malaysia based on sometimes whether or not we can afford these treatments, not whether you need the treatments. So you may be able to see over the causeway over there in Singapore that these treatments are available, but for some reason they're not available here. Why is that? And one of the reasons is because the government may look and say, oh, we can't afford this treatment, it's too expensive, and therefore refuse to bring in that innovative treatment into Malaysia because it feels that then it would be forced to fund that treatment. Now think about it at the individual patient's level. Say if you needed one particular treatment, your doctor looks at you and says to himself, you can't really afford this, so I'm going to suggest you a suboptimal treatment which you can probably afford. Not based on what you need, but based on what you can afford. Is that the way that you want your treatment plan to progress? No, right? You want to be told what's the best for your treatment, and you will find out how I shall find a way to get that treatment that's needed. But that there should be a compromise in between. So one thing that we need to realize today is Malaysia is facing a crippling crisis of non-communicable diseases as a result of, you know, before COVID happened, we already had an NCD crisis, you know, diabetes, like 4 million people who are living or don't know that they have diabetes, people with cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and so forth. So when we add on to the fact that we have an aging population that is growing by the day, and Malaysia has been declared as ill-prepared or unprepared to deal with an aging population, don't you think we need to relook at the way we are investing in our healthcare and we're funding? And that's where we need to look at countries like Japan, for example, that has dealt with aging population and start thinking maybe at age 40, yeah, shall it? Maybe we should contribute beginning from age 40 into a fund that goes towards supporting us when we're older at age 60, so that at least you have 20 years worth of contributions towards an aging fund. There's no way that we can depend on pension schemes and savings from 20 years ago, because it's not going to be enough for us for the next two decades.
We do actually have a question on long-term care insurance. What is being done on long-term care insurance in Malaysia? How much is a Malaysian expected to pay given the fact that we start earning at 25, retire at 55, maybe 60?
Yeah. The situation in Malaysia, there's a couple things to keep in mind. Number one, the infrastructure is not there. The number of quality assisted living facilities or nursing homes is just not there. Secondly, the cost of long-term care or long-term care insurance, there's been some very bad experience or results in I can relate to in North America, for instance, right? So and you know, it almost runs counterintuitive to when you think about people living longer, but they're living longer, with chronic illnesses, and the need for long term care has increased over the years as people have lived longer, and so it's actually a very expensive proposition. I was just looking up the other day for a male age 55 or 60, the premium is $5,000 a year for the U.S., right? It's a lot, right? Now, Singapore had an interesting, I don't know if you'd call it an experiment or what, but about 15 years ago, they implemented a program where that every Singaporean reaching age 40, they will automatically be enrolled for long-term care insurance, paid for 20 years, unless they opt out. And the premiums at age 40 are quite reasonable. And so it basically is meant to obviously give 20 years or so, right, or longer, right, of contributions into a policy that would then ultimately hopefully benefit you in that regard. But right now, Malaysia just doesn't have the infrastructure or the you know.
What are you paying for? What are you insuring for,
yeah,
right? You need the services.
I mean, most long-term care actually probably takes place in the home. Right, where you bring in a helper or somebody to assist, right? But there have been a number of years ago, maybe it was 20 years ago, there were a couple of companies in Malaysia that were offering long-term care insurance, but it wasn't popular and it didn't stick.
You know, going back to the theme of finding new sources of funding, I also wanted to highlight how much it's costing us to treat some of the diseases. And the government right now is in the process wanting to introduce something called the Tobacco and Smoking Control Bill, which is supposed to come out in Parliament in July. I really must, without any hesitation, ask you to urge your members of Parliament to support this bill, because we really need to do something with regards to the impact that smoking does to our healthcare. And I give you an example in terms of how much it is costing us. If you look at treating smoking-related illnesses, some of which was probably discussed earlier today, we like to talk about the fact that we tax tobacco, right? But when you look at how much we use to treat these illnesses, it's actually for every ringgit that we collect from tobacco, we are spending actually ringgit in terms of treating the illnesses as a result of tobacco. So it's not enough. And so we need to do something about that today, not tomorrow, not next year, or some other today, in order for us to be able to do something. And we need to also earmark, because it's not just about national health insurance, but it's also about making sure we have additional revenues. We are collecting money from tobacco and alcohol sales, but do you know none of that is earmarked for health? So we need to change that. We need to earmark, make sure the money that's collected from these is going to promotion of preventative health measures for treatment and so forth.
So if we're talking about getting more funding, getting different, diverse sources of funding, how do we ensure that we get more from what's spent. How can we improve procurement of drugs, medical devices, infrastructure, etc., in the public healthcare system to ensure we get the best bang for our buck, right?
It's a tricky question, but if you look at the public health system, believe it or not, we are using three different streams to procure our drugs. Not one, three. So if you know purchasing in bulk, you know if you purchase one, you get a cheaper rate compared to three. So right now, we're not doing it well. We need to pool that procurement and make sure that instead of purchasing 100, 100, 100, we are purchasing 300 sekaligus. So the government needs to be smarter when it comes to procurement today. It needs to also have negotiators at that level, people who know the industry, people who are able to understand what drives, what the push-pull factors are, but most importantly, tough people who are able to negotiate what's best. But here's the thing, it's not just about getting the best prices, the best value. We need to make sure that we are able to access those services as well, meaning even if it's expensive, we need to look at how we look at value. Is the value measured in terms of its ability to improve on the quality of life or the years of a person living? Not how much a drug costs. We need to re-examine how we look at value when we are making these sort of decisions as well.
You're listening to an edited recording of the third panel session at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality. We'll be right back after another quick break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. This is an edited recording of the third panel session at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality on healthcare financing. Here's the final part from that session.
Using EPF to link to those contributions, you know, that how could that link to the overall insurance scheme that you were talking about?
You know, Shao-It, just now you mentioned about out-of-pocket payments, right? And the fact is that around 35% of health expenditure today is out-of-pocket. That's around 10 billion. That's coming out from savings, from households, from crowdfunding, from EPF. And that's coming from your pockets, from your hard-earned cash. And it shouldn't be this way. The out-of-pocket payment should be lower than 35%. There's no reason why it should be so high. And the reason why it's so high is because you are individually having to manage the catastrophic costs of an unexpected medical condition or incident. And it should not be a situation where you have to make a decision between your kids' education or your healthcare, and that you're having to make that. It shouldn't be the case. So we need to be able to look at it differently. And that's why I say, if you need to withdraw from EPF, which is what they say, what simpanan hari tua anda, when you're age 30 or 40, where you're basically having to wipe it out because you have to treat cancer, for example, then there is no hari tua.
Exactly.
So you shouldn't need to withdraw from EPF, even though we're thankful that that is a facility that's provided today. But we need to find a way to make sure that we're able to provide the healthcare you need to treat your cancer at age, whatever age that you're at, and not wipe out your savings for your old age.
I want to look a little bigger picture. Preventive healthcare or preventive health behaviours. We do have a question. We had two, and now, you know, healthcare is more like sick care. Our audience has pointed out that, you know, we're paying to treat. We're not paying to prevent diseases. We're not investing to prevent diseases. So, you know, your thoughts, investment should be put into green and blue spaces, decentralized healthcare, creating resilient communities. And Mark, from an industry perspective, and again, we always think, well, your bottom line is to make sure that people buy more insurance. How does the idea of preventive healthcare play into what your industry is looking at?
Well, I think it's getting more and more attention, of course. You know, more insurers are offering access to wellness, or actually even offering incentives for policyholders to maintain certain levels of activity that have been proven to improve one's health, right? I think most, if not all, of the large companies have programs like this. But the question might rightfully be whether those programs are effective or enough, right? It's really just a bit of the beginning, right? I think, first of all, there has to be a lot more awareness. And this is where the industry, in terms of the organization that I work for, Liam, can also come in terms of making the public more aware, educating the public, even from a younger age, right? What one has to do throughout their lifetime to maintain a healthy lifestyle, right? You don't have to wait until you're 50 years old or older to become concerned about your health. So I think the industry has a responsibility to help in that way, right? And then to provide access to wellness, and in some cases, benefits for wellness.
How will that affect the amount of premiums that I have to pay? How's that going to affect the inflation you talked about?
Well, I mean, I think, the jury is out on that because I don't think there's been any long-term studies on programs like you walk 10,000 steps a day and then you get a lower premium. Does that really, you know, I mean, it'll take a couple of decades probably for that kind of information to emerge. But it is quite intuitive, like if you're active, right? And the other thing with insurers, the reality is that I may give a discount and incent a person to maintain certain activity today, but I may not be there. I may not benefit down the road from that person's good health. They may not be my customer any longer. So, but generally on the macro level, right, everyone would benefit, right, from people being more active, from people being more mindful about their diets, etc. But I've not seen any data of any sizable amount, right, that shows how that results in lower premiums, for instance.
Okay. So Azrul, Mark is a very, evidence data person. But again, it's not rocket science. You're healthy today. It's going to reap you benefits later on, right? From that broader public health perspective?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's a no-brainer, right? I mean, if you are going to be much more healthier, you're going to put people like Mark here out of business, or the private healthcare guys. The less of our money goes to them, the better it is, right? I mean, but the reality is that we need to invest in our health before that can happen, and we don't do enough of that, especially when it comes to preventive health,
What kind of investments are we talking about?
Well, for one thing, we need to have insurance is important, and that needs to be emphasized. Whether it's national health insurance or private insurance, we need to have some sort of protection against catastrophic illness because there will be catastrophic expenditure. And then second is that we need to be proactive in taking care of our own health. We need to realize that whatever we do today, whether later we have the buffet that's going to be kindly provided by BFM, whether we're going to enjoy that. We also have to think about what we're putting into our bodies, which could result in disease and medical conditions. And I just mentioned earlier about how we're in the crisis of NCDs, that we have a part to do in terms of preventing. But here's the thing, Xiaoyi, I want to make sure that when we talk about healthcare, we're not talking about what we cannot afford, but how can we make sure we afford to be able to provide the kind of treatments for rare diseases, for example, disability or mental health and so forth, so that we are ensuring that nobody is going to be left behind as a result of that. And here's the thing, in the hospital setting, there is a hospital emergency code that's used to call for a life-saving procedure, emergency, and that's called Code Blue. So I would say that for Malaysia right now, when it comes to healthcare, in Malaysia, we are actually at Code Blue, and we need to do something about it.
So what's the, and if I could wrap up with this and get one final message from each of you. Well, I can't give you an unlimited wish list, but what is the one thing you wish you could see in the Minister of Health's white paper for healthcare reforms that he's supposed to announce in November?
Well, I would really like to see a meaningful, not just discussion, but meaningful action in terms of a national health insurance scheme, right? In the short term, I would like to see measures taken to incent or mandate a co-sharing of costs with insurance that will drive better behavior and better consumption. At the same time, greater transparency and costs from private providers. And so, if you look at the average hospital bill, 50 to 70%, as I said, comes from hospital charges, not from the doctor charges, right? But patients don't have information prior to utilizing healthcare about the cost. And so if you have a combination of a modest co-share of costs, together with empowering the consumer with the knowledge of the costs for various institutions, then I think you'll get better healthcare consumption.
Azrul, your one thing?
So for myself, we need to be able to, first of all, make sure that the tobacco and smoking control bill is supported in Parliament in the upcoming session. It needs to pass. Second is that we need to ensure that national health insurance kicks off for real this time and make it happen. And we need to make sure that it's not embedded in the white paper, but also that you hear, which is the most important thing really, Shaoyit, is that the public supports this way forward, because it is the way forward for the future. And whatever national health insurance that gets introduced, we need to make sure it contains three principles. One is that it's equitable in terms of access and benefits. It's able to provide the same kind of benefits and access to all, regardless of socioeconomic strata. It needs to be effective and egalitarian in terms of cost control. And thirdly, which is very important, that such a national health insurance needs to be simple so that the public can understand and utilize that. So let's make sure that these two things happen with the tobacco bill and the national health insurance in the way forward for national healthcare.
Thank you so much to everyone. This has been an amazing morning with you. That was an edited recording of the third and final panel session at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality on the policy reforms and systemic changes that we need for healthcare that we can all afford. This event was presented by AIA, enabling healthier, longer, better lives. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.